You are listening to the Horse Radio Network, part of the Equine Network family.
Welcome to the Horses Equine Innovators Podcast, sponsored by Zoetis. I'm your host, Stephanie Church, editorial director at thehorseandthehorse.com. Every day, researchers at universities and other institutions around the world are examining new ways to care for and understand our horses. In this podcast series, we talk to those innovators to learn more about their work. EHV1 has been everywhere online lately, and not all the information circulating is accurate. Today, we'll focus on what the science tells us, how equine herpes virus infects and spreads, why latency matters, what testing can and can't show, how the neurologic form develops, and how vaccination and biosecurity fit into a thoughtful response. We'll also address a few misconceptions that have gained traction during the recent outbreak and talk about where the research on herpes virus is going next. Joining us are Dr. Abby Sage and Dr. Lute Skoring, who are both equine veterinarians and boarded internists. They will help us sort through the science and bring clarity to the current conversation. Dr. Sage served in multiple leadership roles at veterinary schools, spent 10 years in private practice, and then ran the equine programs in the Virginia State Veterinary Office. She's now an equine technical services veterinarian for Zoetis. Dr. Goering is the Warren Wright Senior Lucille Wright Markey Endowed Chair in Equine Infectious Diseases at the University of Kentucky's Gluck Equine Research Center. His research group focuses on EHV1. Welcome, doctors.
Thank you for having us.
Morning.
Dr. Sage, could you start us out with a short summary of why equine herpes virus is such an important topic right now?
Yes, Stephanie, thanks for bringing this up, because we are currently experiencing an outbreak of equine herpes myeloencephalopathy in the United States. It originated at the Women's Professional Rodeo Association World Finals and Elite Barrel Race event that was held in Texas in Waco in November 5th to the 9th. And as of today's report on the EDCC, which is the Equine Disease Communication Center, it has spread to 8 states with 60 horses infected, and many more are currently still under quarantine. Although the outbreak doesn't really affect the vast majority of horses in the U.S., it's a good reminder to us that we should take biosecurity very seriously every day, not just when an infectious disease, when we're experiencing an infectious disease outbreak.
And just for context, today is December 17th, Wednesday. That's when we're talking about those updates to the EDCC. Thank you, Dr. Sage. So Dr. Goering, could you explain how EHV infects a horse, how it spreads in a population, and why we hear about outbreaks every few years?
So it is a respiratory tract virus. It affects the respiratory tract. It uses the cells in the respiratory tract, upper respiratory tract, to replicate. And so in every little droplet that comes out of the nose, that comes out of the respiratory tract, there's virus in there once these horses become infected. Once a horse becomes infected, it becomes a multiplier. So imagine that in every droplet, in every sneeze, in every snort, there's virus in those little droplets. And this is actually how virus spreads from one horse to the other. Most efficient way of spread is the direct contact. Right, two horses rubbing noses. This is where a huge amount of virus can cross from one horse into the other. Short distance travel is an option, is a very potent option for this virus to cross from one horse into the other. What we call fomites, objects, hands, body parts that transfer virus after contact from one horse to the other is a reason for transmission. And you initiate a cascade when this is not halted. So several horses start replicating, and this is how an outbreak actually spreads. The second question was why we see outbreaks so now and then. And I think this is a major misconception. We see these outbreaks regularly, and I counted, let's say, over the years, and for North America, so Canada and the United States together, we have somewhere between 40 to 80 outbreaks that are reported on the EDCC webpage every year. And there's a gray zone, I would say, of unreported outbreaks that add up to that. Those outbreaks usually are at home facilities, at home barns. They are not, you know, they are not explosive. They're not in the news. However, these outbreaks at shows, at equestrian shows, they are quite rare and only happen, luckily, once every 5 years, 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
These are my numbers.
Okay. Thank you. And so could you briefly explain how EHV1 can lead to EHV myeloencephalopathy and what factors might increase that risk?
So the myeloencephalopathy, or abbreviated EHM, that's a multifactorial disease. What's a strict requirement is that you have infection of the respiratory tract, you have migration of virus that goes to the local lymph nodes, it replicates there, and from that point on, virus can disseminate, can spread through the bloodstream in cells, packaged white blood cells, packaged through the bloodstream, and goes what we call viremic phase.
Mm-hmm.
This is a transportation phase, virus in the bloodstream. This is how this virus reaches the small vessels, blood vessels, in the mainly the spinal cord and in the central nervous system. It causes an infarct-like picture, stroke, multiple strokes at several levels of the spinal cord. And the more of these stroke phenomena we have in the spinal cord, the more severe will be the disease outcome. Factors that you need for this infection is definitely this viremic phase, so the spread through the body for a virus to reach the spinal cord and the central nervous system. But there are viral factors that promote this. There are viruses that viral strains among the family of EHV1 that are more prolific, that go into a higher proportion of viremia for longer days. So there's a more of a shower into the spinal cord post disease, but there are also host factors that favor the development of this neurologic component. And we have a strong connection with breed, with age, and with the female sex. Those horses are more likely to develop EHM, while a majority of horses will develop viremia. Only a proportion of the viremic horses will develop EHM. When it comes to breed, what's important to realize, it's the tall horse that is more likely to be affected with EHM. The sport horses, the quarter horses, western, the paint horses, standardbred, saddlebred, thoroughbred, and less likely are the Arabians, the smaller breeds, pony breeds.
Uh-huh.
in this summary.
I realize I should probably zoom back a little bit and ask, okay, so what does this disease actually look like in a horse that's affected with respiratory versus what do those infarctions cause in the neurologic horse? Can you just describe, either one of you, describe what these signs look like practically to the horse owner and veterinarian?
Sure, I can. So when the horse is first infected, it will show and can show respiratory signs. So these are in young horses generally. Will show nasal discharge, not usually a cough, a slight fever. They become lethargic. They don't want to eat very much. And usually that lasts only 3 to 4 days. And in most horses, if we see any signs at all, those would be the signs that we see. However, in horses that develop the neurologic form, then we will start to see a real variety of signs. So they can show anything. The classic, I'll say, is this what we call an ascending paresis, where they become very weak in the hind end first. There's often pictures in all the veterinary textbooks about dog sitting where the horses can't really get up. I've seen a lot of EHM cases. I honestly have never seen that, but that is sort of the classically described one of the signs. They also will be unable to urinate and defecate. But then those signs classically will ascend up through the spinal cord and can affect the front limbs. I would say in my experience with the cases that I have seen, almost always the first horse that's seen in an outbreak is almost always down. and usually happens quite quickly. So they'll describe they were riding the horse that afternoon and this evening, the horse was down and unable to rise. And that's generally the index horse, although certainly we can see lots of other signs as well. And then we'll see then a variety of neurologic signs. So they can be everywhere from encephalitis-like signs or just really very specific neurologic signs, maybe even one-sided. It just depends based on the pathophysiology that Dr. Goering described. It really can hit a lot of places in the nervous system.
Thank you.
If I may want to add up a second, a comment is like, and I want to introduce the term first hit effect. This is what Dr. Sage described as the index case. Usually, if we have an outbreak with cases of neurologic disease and mixed with fever cases over with a duration of, let's say, 4 to 6 weeks, we see those very intense, the severely affected horses at the very beginning of the outbreak. The first half of an outbreak, that is the one that usually shows the majority of all neurologic cases. While interestingly enough, the second half of an outbreak, that's the one where we see mostly only some febrile cases and some socked up limbs coming on top of that as signs of viremia, but we don't see a large number of neurologic cases.
Okay, thank you. So Dr. Sage, could you walk us through the current testing options for EHV1, what they detect, when we find them most useful, and how to interpret those results in the context of an outbreak?
Sure. So the gold standard for testing is the PCR, and that should be performed on a nasal swab and whole blood. In my experience, sometimes you will get a positive on nasal swab and sometimes whole blood, especially when you're in the middle of an outbreak, you're not sure how long horses have been incubating the disease. So we want to do those together as a PCR. And if we have a suspect horse that we're testing and that test comes back negative, we want to repeat that test within 24 to 48 hours because nasal shedding and viremia take a little time to develop. And so we want to be sure that our negative is truly a negative. There are some stall side tests that are available. One that has not been approved yet by the USDA, but is in use. And if that comes up positive, so that would tell us if we had EHV1, that should always be followed with a PCR to be sure that we do have a positive. And if it's negative, we should also follow that up with a PCR because we want to be sure that when we're saying it's negative, it actually is. Some people use a serum amyloid A test to help determine if a horse potentially could be infected. The serum amyloid A may rise before we see a fever or before we have a positive PCR. And so in the case of the stall side test or the serum amyloid A, we want to be sure that if those are positive, that we isolate that horse while we're waiting for the PCR test to come. So they can be very helpful in an outbreak to kind of start to remove horses that are potentially infected, but it's always the PCR that makes us decide. And I will just say we only want to test horses that have been exposed and that we suspect have clinical signs. We don't want to be testing horses that have not been exposed. Horses will shed EHV1. Intermittently, I think one study showed if you go to a horse show and you test all the horses at the horse show, 4% of them will be shedding. So it won't help matters if we have a positive with no clinical signs and we don't know how long that horse will shed. We don't know if it's infectious. We don't know how it fits into the outbreak. So when we're in a quarantine situation, we only test horses with clinical signs.
Okay, thank you. There's a whole world of guidelines for this, isn't there?
Yes. In fact, I sat on a committee where we worked on, and Dr. Goering also, where we worked on guidelines for state animal health officials so that they have, and it's about, I don't know how many pages long it is, 30 pages. It's long.
Goodness. That was very important work. Okay. So, Dr. Goering, you have researched EHV1 extensively. What aspects of this outbreak do you find compelling or even unusual, or has the recent outbreak unfolded in a pretty typical way?
But it's a rare event. Luckily, it's a rare event. And I kind of think back of a timeline where we had the Ogden outbreak in 2011, followed by Or even earlier than that, there was a Florida outbreak in Shoah's population. Really, in Florida, there was an outbreak at a venue, at an equestrian event in Utah. And then there was a number of years of relative quiescence. We had the large Valencia outbreak in Spain in 2021. And we had also horses going to a venue for training and for competing. We had a very recent outbreak, which was a novelty in Chile, near Santiago, an outbreak where horses developed neurologic signs shortly after arrival. And then disease was propagating among the horses in those different barns at the show ground. What's compelling to me here is that this shows that what I realized when I was talking about the first hit effect, this is when horses that shed, apparently they come into a new environment and they encounter horses that see this virus, vaccinated or not, but they are unprepared. They're caught off guard to see this virus. This is when we see those neurologic cases coming up suddenly. And we see that this neurologic chain event happens like in a chain event, like once horses return or they go to new places and they apparently seed virus into this new environment. That's, to me, the compelling aspect of this outbreak.
Okay, thank you. So let's talk about vaccination. Let's talk about prevention. Our listeners are by nature very preventive care focused. Dr. Sage, could you address EHV1 vaccination?
Yes. So unfortunately, there is no vaccine on the market that will prevent the neurologic form of EHM or equine herpes virus. However, that doesn't mean we should not be vaccinating, because we have shown, and there are several studies that have shown, that vaccination can decrease the amount of nasal shedding, decrease the amount of virus in the environment. And in some cases, such as with pneumovirus, K plus 1B can actually decrease viremia, at least a little somewhat. So we want to vaccinate because we want to protect all the horses in the environment. And we want to make sure we have less virus that is present, so less horses hopefully will become infected. But not only horses that are traveling or competing should be vaccinated, all the horses that are in the home barn that will see those horses should also be on the same vaccine schedule. And that is, again, to prevent those horses from shedding and increasing the virus in the environment. And in our brood mares, we want to vaccinate them at 5, 7, and 9 months. And that's, we're really trying to prevent abortion there. But also the horses on the farm should be on a similar vaccine schedule to those horses, again, to try and make herd immunity and decrease the amount of virus in the environment as possible. And we found that to be somewhat helpful. We, Zoetis, partnered with the National Finals Rodeo in the last couple of years to vaccinate all of the stock horses that are used in that setting. And they found that that's been quite effective in decreasing the amount of illness that those horses have shown, because historically they have not really received vaccination. So it's been useful. So we want to keep up vaccination, even though we know it doesn't prevent the neurologic form, because hopefully we are protecting all the other horses.
Indeed. Thank you. So Dr. Gehring, how about biosecurity to prevent EHV coming on the farm? You mentioned it earlier with fomites and such. Let's dive into it a little deeper here.
So biosecurity definitely is something you need to have prepared this in greater detail. You have to allow these notes you make for biosecurity, that they sink in with all the people on a farm, that they understand what it means to prevent transmission of this virus from going from one horse to the other. I think you can go in very deep detail. I think the most profound things to consider is actually to prevent immediate contacts between a horse that is coming new to the farm, that is coming from a sale, that is a new boarder on a farm. A lot of horses are carriers of EHV1. We call that latent carriers. And these horses, when they are transported, when they go to shows, when they go to also see, when they see the vet, when they move around, they have the capacity to reactivate that dormant virus in their tissues, reactivate, and it returns to the respiratory tract. It may be shed in a little and small amounts. And we need to make sure that new horses in the herd, that they are not in immediate contact with others. I even recommend that new horses that come to a farm, that they should be tested before they mix with the other horses. It's a brief period of acclimatization for these horses, but it would be, I think, a major move forward to test these horses. And in case they shed, we just wait with the introduction before we get them into contact and sit it out until they stop shedding. The other risk factor is the returning horses from any type of horse event, even if these are visits from a veterinary hospital or from a veterinary clinic. They may undergo the same thing of reactivation and shedding small amounts with their nasal secretions. And this is something we can sit out. We need to wait. We need to make sure these horses don't have an immediate nose-nose contact with any other horses. Certainly, we can avoid unnecessary contact between horses year-round, but I think that's a very tedious thing to consider as a biosecurity measure. Definitely, the towel that wipes the nostrils of a horse should not go from one horse to the other. A brief hand wash is sufficient to wash off virus if there is a large number of viral particles on your hands. I think these are most important things to prevent transmission under home circumstances at a facility.
In prep for show season or any travel with your horse, ask your vet about Core EQ Innovator and FluVac Innovator EHV 4-in-1 by Zoetis. They are a perfect pair of vaccines designed to help provide comprehensive core and respiratory disease coverage for your horse. So let's say I take my horse up to a local riding area and meet a friend from another premises to go for just a trail ride. The horses don't touch noses, but you know, they're walking 3 or 4 feet away from each other for the full ride. They're both healthy. They're both vaccinated. If I bring my horse back to the farm, do I have to be that careful if it's just like a ride 15 minutes up the road?
Honestly, we don't know for sure. My gut tells me it's unlikely that something will happen in those very casual short, and the horse is used to this, right? I mean, it's the other example is a horse goes to an event. It's excited to go there. It performs there. There are certain stimuli, I believe, that allow virus to reactivate. And it's more than average stimuli that cause this. So it's probably not the trail ride, the shared trail ride to come back. But it's more like, you know, the more eventful situations.
Mm-hmm. With a lot of horses stabled in the same area, you hear horses whinnying at each other, that kind of thing.
Okay. Yes. Yeah. And it's more the impact of these shows that, you know, the excitement. I don't want to call it necessarily stress, but it's more like the excitement when this virus takes the chance to reactivate.
Okay. Thank you. And Dr. Sage, let's say there's EHV diagnosed in a barn already and there's an active outbreak. What type of quarantine and biosecurity efforts do you recommend going into that facility?
So EHM is reportable to the state veterinarian in all states. And almost every state will, the animal health official, state veterinarian, will actually run the quarantine. So once they are aware that there is a suspect case or that there is a confirmed case, that animal health official will do an epidemiologic investigation, determine what horses are infected, what horses have been exposed, and then they will quarantine those facilities where those horses reside. In addition, they'll do what we call a trace back, where they will look back 14 days to see if any of the horses on that farm came in contact with other horses. And then those horses that will be deemed exposed in that way would then also be under quarantine. And then once they're under quarantine, then usually we will develop an isolation area within that farm. And many farms, you know, when you first approach this, they say, well, we don't have an isolation area. And that's true. Most people don't have one. But if you think about it, you can often make an area. We try and separate those horses by 30 feet. So the infected versus the exposed. So sometimes it can be a paddock. Sometimes it can be round pen. Sometimes, you know, it can be a part of the barn. But if possible, we want that animal health official will develop an isolation area. And then any horse that is deemed infected will go there. And then any horse that shows clinical signs prior to testing would also go into isolation. And that's because we want to keep any horse that might be actively shedding that we know removed from the rest of the population. And the idea is, yep, maybe they're all been exposed, but maybe they're not all shedding in high amounts. And if we can remove those horses that are actively shedding, we may decrease the amount of horses that actually become clinical. So those horses move into the isolation area. And then really, there's biosecurity practiced on the entire farm, but more so for those horses in isolation areas. So that includes wearing PPE, disposable gloves, using foot baths, and minimizing the people that are handling the horses, minimizing the people on and off of that farm as much as possible. Horses that are under quarantine and are exposed probably shouldn't be receiving a lot of exercise unless, you know, it's more stressful not to receive that exercise. So, for example, sometimes it's in boarding facilities that do lessons. Those lessons that just don't take place at that time because we want to minimize all the activity that's going on in a farm. And usually the quarantines will last, and then it depends on the state and how they run it, but 21 to 28 days. And then from the last horse that showed clinical signs and tested positive, and from then on.
Okay, great. Thank you. All right, so let's get into some myths and misconceptions that I've seen on social media over the past few weeks with the recent outbreak. Dr. Gehring, first, can vaccination against EHV1 cause infection?
So the vaccination itself will not cause infection. And even if we use what's called a modified live virus vaccine, that's a stunted virus that is capable of replication, we will not induce disease. We will not induce infection with a vaccine.
Okay, thank you. And what about, we talked a little bit about how there isn't a vaccination that will prevent EHM, but what is there a connection between vaccination and cases of EHM?
So being vaccinated, it's a stimulus for the immune system to prevent that cascade that happens, respiratory tract replication, going into viremia. And I always say, like, every little bit helps, right? And it's multifactorial disease. Many things come together, virus strain, host factors, distance of that have to where this virus has to travel from one horse to the other, all the very important factors, whether we get initial infection and the cascades down through viremia and etiologic disease. I've witnessed plenty of outbreaks in completely unvaccinated, on completely unvaccinated premises. And I must say, if I consider tall horses an at-risk population to develop EHM after infection, I end up with 50% of EHM. Certainly, vaccination can prevent. It will not prevent in all cases, but it definitely will help to lower that number compared to the unvaccinated population.
Great. Thank you for explaining that. So Dr. Sage, your turn. I have seen the public discussing infected horses on farms that have a stable population with no horses shipping in and out and no, you know, excessive foot traffic. I've seen speculation about whether horses being transported on a road adjacent to their pastures could cause infection. Let's say the trailer window is open. Now, this doesn't seem possible to me from the things I've reported on over the past 26 years, but I do want to put the rumors in front of the experts. What are your thoughts on this type of speculation?
So what? First off, EHM is really quite a rarity. It doesn't happen often. So I think, you know, when we get these big outbreaks, everyone is very concerned and rightfully so, but really they're very unusual. And with all the horses coming and going and trailering and whatnot, we really don't see this very commonly. That said, I always say, because you have a horse, there is some risk that horse could develop EHM or equine herpes virus. And that's because we know it is latent in the horse and they can start shedding. Most of the outbreaks that we see are in, you know, horses that are traveling or commingling with other horses. However, I have presided over a few quarantines where the horses did not leave the farm. I can remember one where there were about 7 horses on the farm. Those horses never left the farm. The owners had no contact with other horse owners, and the veterinarian and the farrier had not been on the farm. We really couldn't find a stressor on the farm other than, you know, who knows, fox ran through the pasture, or, you know, horses get stressed by, mm-hmm. by a rock that they hadn't seen yesterday. But so it can, and one horse did develop EHM with 2 more to follow. And so I think it's something that it's a risk that we take by owning horses. And it is, you know, among other infectious diseases, when we move our horses from place to place and commingle them, that's part of the joy of having horses and the fun of it. I think we just have to keep it in perspective and try to do the best that we can by vaccinating, taking precautions when we bring horses home, taking temps. I think that is huge when we go to horse shows. If we could take horses' temps twice a day at a horse show, and any horse with a fever, that horse could be isolated or removed from the show grounds, would be huge. And that's something that we're doing more and more of at shows, but that is a huge thing that could really help with these big outbreaks.
Thank you, Dr. Sage.
Can I just comment
on
this real quick? My same experience, like, right, we had like maybe the one outbreak where we really couldn't identify how this disease came in onto the premises. And we indeed had this argumentation, fox ran through. That's a great storyline to tell. But usually it is very worthwhile to kind of trace back what happened 10 days before actually the person who lodged the horse appears, because that's the critical time frame, the time window we need to get EHM in a horse. This is the number of days that go by typically before we see neurologic disease. And, you know, if you dig deep in this time period, this is very rewarding usually to identify some of those connections of horses that has been transported, that has been in contact, that went through these premises. And people often forget because it's already 2 weeks ago. The other comment I have is, like, yes, it's very, very, very important to do twice a day temperature taking. And I strongly believe that it's very, 4 times very more important to take evening temperatures than morning temperatures.
Oh, interesting.
So please don't take twice a day temperatures at 11 and at 1 o'clock, but take them in the afternoon, evening hours.
Okay.
It's higher yield of finding a fever.
Okay. Interesting. Thank you. Have you heard any misconceptions about EHV1 in the wake of this recent outbreak, Dr. Gehring?
Misconceptions, of course, everybody's shocked by the number of neurologic cases. Everybody suspects this is like a mutant virus, a new variant, something that's out of the ordinary, and it's more aggressive. This is what we hear a lot. And then the misconceptions of what Dr. Sage already touched with, you know, unlikely that by passing a window which ventilates a barn where horses are in there, it's probably not the way of transmission. It's not productive enough for transmission. On the strain variant, I think what the laboratories tell me is that the majority of samples bear this more neuropathogenic, more neuropathogenic strain. So a strain that is more likely to cause neurologic disease. This is like 2 or 3 strains that are different, and we know that for decades, that this is one group that is more prolific, that is more easier, that is easier to cause viremia, that is easier to cause respiratory tract infection and therefore spreads easier. This is the one that has been identified during these outbreaks on several occasions. Certainly we are very interested in identifying what the fine print, what the details are of this virus, which will require sequencing of this virus. I think this is also underway already. And we will know more about this virus in a few weeks.
Great. Thank you. So Dr. Sage, what about from your area of the world? Have you heard any misconceptions that you'd like to address about this disease?
Yes, I think a lot of people think that it's a highly fatal disease and that horses will not recover from it. And then certainly, you know, there are horses that die from this. They're usually the recumbent horses that cannot be adequately maintained and properly cared for. It's just they're often much sicker than the other horses. But when we looked at when they looked at the Valencia outbreak, this was the first time I had actually seen numbers like this. They looked at horses that became neurologic and what happened to them down the line. And I think about 68% of them returned to exercise. And these were the neurologic horses, and over 50% of them returned to their previous level of exercise. So although it can be quite a devastating disease, really most horses will recover from it, even if they have neurologic signs, and can go on to be very useful.
You need a long breath, usually. It's not like within days or a few weeks that you see the final result. It usually takes several months until you have concluded that recovery phase.
Okay. And we have some stories, archive stories about the Valencia outbreak, and also some deep dive stories into EHV1 that I'll make sure I link to in the show notes so that the listener can learn some more. So Dr. Gehring, I believe I last interviewed you for this podcast about 3 years ago. Have there been any research developments during that time that you feel are relevant to the current state of EHV in the United States?
So research developments, I wrote down a few things, key papers. There's a paper out there showing that there is a difference whether you see this virus infecting young horses versus old horses. This is like where you go into the risk factor analysis. Yes, older mares, tall horses are more susceptible to come down with neurologic disease. This is Dr. Hussey from Michigan State University. They saw way more neurologic disease in the old mare population compared to the young horse population. It does not take away that you will never get neurologic disease in the youngsters, but the ratio is totally different. We had one horse out of 10 with neurologic disease among the yearling horses, and we had more than 80% of neurologic disease in the older mares.
Wow.
Major accomplishments have been done with the rapid testing. Dr. Sage touched on that with the also including stable or stable site-based testing. It's under development. It's under licensing procedures. We will hear very much more about that in the near future. Everybody, again, let's say 3 years ago, everybody was focused on, you know, this is neurologic disease only happens with a certain number of strains. Strain denomination was very important. We called it the B strain versus the N strain discussion. The Valencia outbreak has been an N strain, which has always been considered the less violent virus causing less neurologic disease. It causes maybe a lower number of neurologic cases, but it definitely causes the same spectrum of neurologic cases. I would think these are the developments of the. Maybe that we also identify what you mentioned already, Stephanie, that we identify virus in low numbers at shows, at events, in veterinary care facilities, at racetracks, in low numbers. And apparently this is a little fog that spreads left and right. We need to find ways to prevent that these small amounts of virus, that they become explosive and find a made-up bed to cause explosive disease.
Okay, thank you. So to each of you, I ask, as innovators in equine health, what do you see for EHV in the next few years from research, from a research and an industry perspective? Dr. Gehring, do you want to start first?
So, of course, there are like very basic questions that need to be answered. You know, what are the details and how can we prevent that virus that originates in the respiratory tract, travels down and reaches the nervous system? We need to understand. We have some understanding of how things go. We think we know what happens at the spinal cord, but we need confirmation. We need more research on that regard. Certainly, we are, several groups are working on novel vaccines. We learned from COVID. We were introduced to RNA vaccines. Groups around the globe are working on novel vaccines against this disease. They have to be tested to be efficacious in cases of, to prevent EHM to develop. People are working on treatment options during infection and whether that's virostatics or other components, other drugs that can be used in lowering virus dispersion. We are also very interested in what drives this virus to reactivate. We know there are a lot of forces are latent infected, dormant infected. What drives this virus to wake up, and can we steer this? Can we prevent reactivation? Which has been quite positive results done in the human fields. We can prevent reactivation with a vaccine. This is the Shingrix vaccination against shingles. We are all latent carriers of chickenpox virus that sleeps in the dorsal root ganglia. It wakes up, it causes shingles, and vaccination has shown to prevent reactivation and growth of virus in the skin. So this is a major project of importance.
Great. Thank you so much. What about you, Dr. Sage? Anything to add about what you see in the next few years about EHV1?
Yeah, well, I hope that, you know, every time we have one of these outbreaks, people start to take biosecurity very seriously. And then it starts to die off when people aren't faced with hearing about it as often. So I always send hopes when we have an outbreak that people will then take their biosecurity more seriously to do things like when you go to a show or use a stall at a facility that you might disinfect it first before you go in by, you know, just using a spray or making sure that it was disinfected before you put your horse there, by taking temperatures when you're away from home. And, you know, removing any horse from a big facility that has a fever. Those little things can make a huge difference. Not, I mean, we can't prevent the disease, but we can try and prevent it from spreading from horse to horse. So I always hope that, you know, this will be the turning point for the industry. But I have noticed over the years that people are taking it more seriously, and there are more and more events that are requiring, you know, horses have their temps taken before they get off the trailer, or even at our veterinary hospitals, there's more interest in that.
And it's the majority of these outbreaks, they have a season. So they happen between October and April, basically. So it's about 90% of all these EHV1 outbreaks with EHM, they happen between these months. So I think we need an alert mechanism. Let's say we need to brief the industry. We need to brief horse owners in the fall. This is what's coming up. This is an increased risk, you know, that's coming for the season. People tend to forget what happens if a summer passes by without any insults. We need to brief people and prepare them for the upcoming season.
That's great. Thank you. Doctors, is there anything you would like to add about maybe resources where horse owners or veterinarians can learn more about EHV1?
Yes, I always point horse owners and veterinarians to the Equine Disease Communication Center. This is a website that is run by the AAEP, the American Association of Equine Practitioners, and it will have the most up-to-date information on a current outbreak. There's also information about lots of other infectious diseases. And it, for horse owners, this is the place to learn about the disease without getting misinformation.
And I will link to that site in the show notes so that you can easily check there. What about you, Dr. Gehring?
So I echo EDCC websites, also the links that guide you to how to, what to do, biosecurity, all the ins and outs, what is EHE1, also the other diseases, the links that have, there's also a great link with AAEP, also to disease outbreak prevention and biosecurity.
I will link to those in the show notes. Thank you so much for your time today.
You're very welcome.
Thank you so much for having us.
EHV raises plenty of questions, and I'm very grateful to our guests for helping us break down the science and realities of managing it. Thanks for joining us for this episode of Equine Innovators.